Hello there, folks. This is Chat with a Cat, episode 24. This is coming to you just after the 1984 rookie draft, prior to free agency. We're going to react to the beginning of the offseason. There were some trades that went down. There were some draft picks made. Some teams reshuffled. And we're going to react to all of that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the mid-level exception, what it is, how it works, because I assumed this year would be the first year that we had to deal with it based on the cap situation of a couple of our teams getting ready for the rookie draft, but obviously going into the rookie draft, a couple teams were going to get access to mid-level exception. Following the rookie draft, enough money moved around and teams decided to dump salary that we're not going to see the mid-level exception. But I think it's good putting out there now what the mid-level exception is and how it's used, because I get the feeling that maybe not this offseason, but in future offseasons, understanding what it is and how it works is going to become important, because more teams are going to need to use it in order to replenish and restock their rosters. So let's get into that. This way everybody has a chance to understand what it is and how it works before you actually have to use it. So maybe make a note of this podcast, write it down when you want to figure out what the mid-level is. I'm going to touch on the lower level exception, even though we don't have it in our league. At least we didn't at the end of the NPBSL, so I assume it's not going to come into play here. But let's talk through these. The way I would describe the mid-level exception is as follows. Imagine when you go into free agency, you have a budget to spend on players to which you do not have some other right for going over the cap. Most commonly is bird rights, but let's say your shopping budget for players is equal to your cap space. I think that's something we're all kind of familiar with. I'm going to use some nice round numbers here. And let's assume that you go into this offseason with $1 million in cap space. That means for bringing in new players that you don't have bird rights on, you have $1 million to work with. Well, what would happen if you were over the cap? How would you be able to get players in on anything other than, say, a veteran minimum contract or using bird rights? The answer is the mid-level exception. So the thing to, or the way to think about the mid-level exception is, this is the smallest size pool of money that you will have to work with when you enter free agency. If you would have less than this amount at the start of free agency, so this calculation is made at the end of the rookie draft, you are granted access to the mid-level exception. And for reference, the mid-level exception this season is a little less than $400,000. If you have $1 million in cap space, you have more than $400,000. You do not get to access the mid-level exception. If you have $500,000 in cap space, you have more than $400,000. You do not get access to the mid-level exception. If you have $200,000 in cap space, you do get access to the mid-level exception. You get the $400,000 to spend. If you are over the salary cap, you get access to the mid-level exception. You have $400,000 to spend. Now, the first thing some of you are thinking of is, oh, cool, if I have $200,000 under the cap, that means I can spend $200,000 of cap space, and then I get to spend $400,000 of mid-level exception money. That means I really have $600,000 of cap space. Wrong. So the way the mid-level exception works, and Fast Break will keep track of this, and if you go to the cap report page, if you have access to the mid-level exception, you will be shown you have a mid-level exception amount. If you have the mid-level exception available, You cannot use other cap space. The moment you qualify for the mid-level exception, you disqualify yourself from using what you might call quote-unquote regular cap space to sign players in the offseason. That means if you reach the end of the draft and you have $200,000under the cap and you qualify for the mid-level exception and then you trade away a player that's making $2 million, you don't have $2 million to play with. You are still limited to the mid-level exception. The calculation is made when the draft is finished and free agency starts, and once that happens, you're locked into either having the mid-level exemption and that being the most you can spend, or you're locked into having cap space. Similarly, if free agency starts, and let's say you're a million under the cap, and you make a trade before free agency is processed, but after the rookie draft is over, and you pick up $900,000 in salary, so now you have just $100,000 left under the cap, you do not get access to the mid-level exception. So whether or not you have the mid-level exception locks in at the time the rookie draft is finished and the free agent period opens. So that's number one. That's when the calculation is made. That's when things are locked in. If you have access to the MLE, you do not get access to your quote-unquote regular cap space. Similarly, if you have access to regular cap space at that time, you can never get access to the MLE that season. So that's the first thing to be aware of. The second thing to be aware of is the MLE acts like virtual cap space in that if you have access to the MLE, you can offer players money, but it has to be using the MLE or some other exception. I'll get into those in a minute. But you can split the MLE up. As an example for this season, you have a $400,000 roughly MLE. You could offer all $400,000 to one player. You could offer $200,000 each to two players. You could offer two players $100,000 each and one player $200,000. Doesn't matter. It works just like cap space, except when you designate that you're going to use it, you have to designate that this is MLE space that you are offering instead of quote-unquote regular cap space. Because again, if you have the MLE, you no longer have regular cap space to work with. And I'm using air quotes here, which doesn't really work because I'm coming to you on a podcast. So I'm not sitting in front of you. But that's the first thing to be aware of, is that the MLE acts exactly like a small salary cap that you can work out of if you've got access to that. The second thing to understand is the lower level exception is almost like a second MLE. We don't use it, but if we ever go to it, the lower level exception is generally about 35% of the MLE. And the difference between the LLE and the MLE is the LLE cannot be split up, meaning you cannot split the LLE and sign two players with it. You have to offer it all to a single player. So that's the first thing to be aware of. And remember, with the MLE, just like cap space, or with the LLE for that matter, with the other one, just like regular cap space, you can offer raises, you can offer multi-year contracts, and so forth. So real quick, let's talk about stuff that you can offer that does not involve the MLE. It will count against your cap if you have cap space open, but you are allowed to go over the cap with these options in addition to the mid-level exception. The number one thing to remember is bird rights, and that one's an easy one. Once a player has 3 years of service without changing teams via free agency, and what that means is if you trade a player, his bird rights go with him, you can offer that player any amount up to the maximum based on his years of service, which is 25% of the cap. If it's under 6 years, 7, 8, 9 years, it's 30% of the cap. 10 or more years, it's 35% of the cap. So basically, once you have bird rights to a player, you can pay him whatever you want. The cap doesn't stop you. The thing to be aware of, though, is if you have a player and you pay him with bird rights, that still counts against your cap for later players. So if you have $1 million in cap space and you use bird rights to sign a player to a $500,000 contract, you now have $500,000 in cap space. If you have $1 million in cap space, you sign three other players to $1 million of contracts and then sign a player with bird rights to a $500,000 contract, you're now $500,000 over the cap. So order matters in these things. And as I've talked about before, the way that Fast Break does deciding in free agency is it ranks players by their hidden future potential rating in order from top to bottom. The highest future potential rating player makes his decision, then the next highest makes his decision, and so on and so forth. And so that happens on each day. We run multiple days. So on day one, everybody has a chance to go through. On day two, everybody has a chance to go through highest to lowest. On day three, everybody has a chance to go through highest to lowest. So usually your best players will sign first. However, it's possible, because of the vagaries of Fast Break, that let's say on day two, your top player doesn't want to sign, but your secondary player does, and he eats up some cap space, or you know, you're offering to another team's free agent, he signs first, and then the better player with bird rights signs on day three or day four or day five. That's legal. You don't have a lot of control over that, but I want to put it out there so you understand how it works, so there's not a lot of Sturm und Drang when this happens in free agency. Look at the order in which players sign. Order matters each quote-unquote day of free agency in game is best to worst, but we run several days in game in each of our free agency periods. Period one, I think we run days 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Period two, I think we run days 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then period three, we run the remaining 20 days. So be aware that that's how it works. And what this means is it is possible for a bid that you make to player A to then cause your bid to player B to become illegal if he signs first and eats up your cap space. But the other thing to remember about that is because the MLE is its own cap, and bird rights don't count against that cap. Let's say you're working with the MLE. It doesn't matter how many bird rights players you sign. That won't take away your MLE cap space. If you're using regular cap space, bird rights players do take that away. So it doesn't make a difference this season because nobody has access to the MLE, but it's something to be aware of for future seasons. And so the bird rights exception is the big one. The second exception is veteran minimum contracts. You are always allowed to offer a veteran minimum one-year contract to players. And that can happen regardless of cap space. It will eat up your salary cap. So again, if you have $1 million of cap space and you put in a veteran minimum offer of $50,000 to someone, and they sign first, you have $950,000 of cap space, meaning if you offered somebody else $1 million and you didn't have bird rights, that player cannot sign with you. So be aware of that as well. It's not as big a deal on day one when everybody is big game hunting, but it comes into play more often on days two and three. The third exception is what are called early bird rights, and that is a player that has not changed teams via trade in two seasons. So it happens before you get to your quote-unquote full bird rights. And early bird rights are similar to bird rights, except there's a maximum on that that usually runs a little less than the MLE to start with. And so the early bird contract is something you can offer someone regardless of cap space as well. It doesn't come up very often in this league. There is a third specific type of exception that can be used, and you can offer this contract whenever, but again, if this player signs, it counts against your cap, even though you can go over the cap to make the signing, and that is the 120% raise rule. And that is For a player with 1 year of service on your team, you can offer them up to 120% of their previous season's contract, regardless of your cap situation. So if you're over the cap, or if signing this contract would take you over the cap, and let's use as an example a, you know what, I will use a hypothetical with a nice round number. Let's say you had a player that made $100,000 last season. You could pay him up to $120,000 this season, regardless of your cap space. If you're over the cap, doesn't matter. You can make that offer. And so that is another way in which you can try to get a player in. So again, at 1 year, you get the 120% raise. If you have a 2 years with a player without changing teams for your free agency, and that could be 2 year, 1 year deals in a row, you can offer them the early bird amount. And then once you get 3 years, you can offer them up to a max. So that's something to be aware of. And again, the MLE is its own beast. No matter where you are with the cap, if you qualified for MLE, you can use the MLE money on MLE players. We'll talk about RFA next year, but I think, you know, this is something that I want to put out there for those of you that are starting to do advanced financial planning as you're mapping out your salaries this season. Be aware that's how the MLE works. Be aware that this season it would be a little less than $400,000. So when you're looking at how much players go for, that tells you about what your budget would get you. So with that, I'm going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about reacting to everything that happened during the draft. I'm going to talk more about trades, I think, than about actual draft picks, because I think the trades were more interesting, but that's just me. It's my show. I get to do it my way. We'll be back in a minute.
Daily Meditation with your host, Tim.
Hi. Today, let's imagine a warm, moist, tropical rainforest during a gentle rain. Let's relax and enjoy the sounds of the rainforest. Oh, look, there's a cute little monkey. Hi, monkey. And a trombone. Let's imagine we're walking along a winding path through the dense foliage. We're not in a hurry. We're just enjoying the sights, the sounds, the smells. Excuse me. We're just walking along without a care in the world, not concerned at all with the slippery mud underfoot.
Whoa!
Or the anvil overhead. Oh dear, looks like you need an ambulance. Hope it doesn't lose traction in the soft, brown mud. The accident seems to have frightened the monkey. And the trombone. And the drill press. And the flock of geese. And the class of second graders. And the monster truck.
Join us tomorrow for another Daily Meditation.
Good lunch, Mom.
Oops. Billy, your milk. Look out.
Oh, Billy.
Out of my way, you old bag.
Who are you, and what are you doing in my house?
I'm the brazen paper towel man, and I'm here to clean up that spill, unless you'd rather use that wimpy, sorry-ass paper towel you usually use.
Well, how good is brazen?
How good is brazen? Shut your trap, and I'll tell you.
Hey, you can't talk to my mom like that.
Shut up, punk, or I'll smack you on the back of the head with my class ring. Brazen paper towels eat spills for breakfast. One single sheet of brazen will sop up a small, scummy pond. See that milk?
Yes.
Well, watch this, baby.
What was that scream?
That was the milk, begging for mercy.
Brazen paper towels. We're an Arthur Daniels Heartland company, but you don't need to know that.
All right, welcome back. Hopefully you enjoyed that break. I know I did. So let's talk trades. The big story to me is never about who is picked when in the draft. I think unless there's something where someone falls surprisingly, and I've covered this earlier, I think generally we do a pretty good job of figuring out which players are going to be the most impactful and picking them in the correct order. So if you have, you know, a top 1, 2, 3 pick and you make your pick, we all kind of knew what that was going to look like. I think, you know, as an example in this draft, we all kind of knew that Michael Jordan was going to go to the Spurs. It's not very interesting, I think, to talk about that in a draft reaction. It might be interesting to talk about how Jordan is going to fit on the Spurs in a season preview. But in a draft reaction, that's not terribly interesting because we all kind of expected that. Now, if Jordan had fallen to number 7, that would be interesting, and I think that would merit talking about, but he didn't, so I'm not going to talk about it. What I am going to talk about is the off-season trades and what I think they portend. And we're going to start with the first trade of the off-season, and that was the Lakers and Hawks, wherein the Lakers sent Jamal Wilkes for Jeff Rulond. This trade, to me, was the Lakers finally finding a taker for one of their wing scorers and getting the big man that they've coveted to put next to Donaldson for a very long time. Is this trade too late? And by that I mean, has the Lakers' core of wings aged too much? And number two, are they going to be able to make a lot of moves after they pay all of the players that are owed max deals? I don't know. For the Lakers, I think this was a little bit of selling low. Rulond took a hit in training camp last season. He's been maybe not the focal point of the Hawks, but a focal point of the Hawks, and he's barely averaged double digits. So he's a C starting big, but he's not dominant. And I think they really would have liked to have done better, but maybe this is what they finally decided. This is as much as they're going to be able to get for Wilkes. It does help the Lakers a little bit in terms of affordability because they were able to ship out some salary here, but Rulon's going to have to be paid in a season. So this kind of kicks the can down the road, but the Lakers are not going to be out from under all those contracts. The backcourt, the front court rather, assuming they're able to bring back Donaldson and Rulond, I think is it's an interesting one. They're very efficient. Donaldson has actually developed into a surprisingly good scorer. I think Magic enhances everybody's scoring around him. So I think they will be fine offensively. I'm not sure I love Rulon defensively. I don't know. Rulond isn't bad, but he's not great either. And I question, is this enough for the Lakers? I think the Lakers will be fine. And I'm operating under the assumption, by the way, that most teams here that have star free agents are going to offer them supermaxes and they are going to come back. And so I think the Lakers will have their entire squad back next year. Rulond allows them to move Magic down to point guard so they can actually get some mismatches there. And that, I think, is the bigger thing that this does rather than helping the Lakers immediately. For the Hawks, they get Wilkes, who's a big-time scorer, but the Hawks are, to me, a team that seems, I don't want to say rudderless, but it seems like they're trying to have a two-timeline thing going on. Roundfield and Wilkes are both 31. They're going to start being in decline. You know, they passed their peak. And then you've got Barkley and Kellogg and Elo and Thompson and Harper coming up. So they've got a team where they've got a bunch of young players on the rise, and they've got two old stars that are in decline. And I don't know that that's a good combination. I do like Wilkes' production relative to his contract. I should say that. I think, you know, Wilkes' contract is very attractive. I'm a little more sanguine about Roundfield's contract. So I think this is kind of a lateral move for the Hawks. I think they did well in terms of talent for what they got for Ruland. The problem is the age, and I don't know how long Wilkes can sustain his level of play. So is this a long-term move for the Hawks? No. Or if the Hawks are trying to get some momentum and build this year, I'm okay with this pick or with this trade. But I just – it doesn't seem like it fits into their strategy, especially with their shopping of Roundfield. It's clear that they are trying to build young and build up around Harper and Elo and Barkley. And Ruland fit that timeline, and Wilkes doesn't. So I'm confused as to what the Hawks are doing here. The next trade that came through, and I'm not going to talk about the tax ramifications of this trade, was the Knicks and Kings. And this was the Kings sending Bernard King and 5 points to the Knicks for the 5th and the 14th pick. This one shocked me. To be honest, the Kings had a very strong squad last season. I felt like the Trailblazers were fortunate to get by them, and you know that they were fortunate because the previous year the Kings vanquished the Trailblazers. So, you know, these are two teams that are evenly matched, and I felt like the Kings, if they brought back their team, would have a title contender ready to go. So when they traded away King and came away with the 5 and the 14, I thought it was an interesting trade for the Kings because it shows, number one, Darth is not afraid to pull the trigger, but number two, that he believed in what he could get at 5 and 14 and that he felt that he would be able to compete right now. And that's interesting to me because typically in the draft, we haven't seen teams able to turn an impact player or turn an early pick into an impact player unless he's the number one or number two pick. Even the 5 picks have not been immediate impact players. And so I thought this was surprising because, you know, is this Darth taking a season not off? I think he would still be a playoff team, but maybe not as a co-favorite to win the title. There were some later moves that he made that made me rethink that. But, again, let's just go with what it is. For the Knicks, this deal is a little bit interesting, too. But I think it's a good pickup. They weren't going to get anybody as talented as King is now at number 5 without some blessings from the TC gods. And King is 27. He's just starting into his prime. They're going to get 4 or 5 really good seasons out of him. You know, he was, I think, number 2 in the league in scoring last season. You know, I could be remembering wrong, but you know, look at his scoring in the 4 seasons of the league. He scored 25 with Portland and their reduce everybody's scoring for the team bit. In Boston, he averaged almost 35. 2 years in Kansas City, he averaged 31 and 29. So he is definitely a capable scorer, and pairing him with Daryl Griffith gives them a terrific 1-2 punch on the wings. I think the Kings would, or the Knicks rather, would still like to get a true power forward in. I don't know if David Greenwood is it. Steve Stepanovich is a little lighter in the rebounding department than I would like for my starting center. I think the Knicks are a good team, probably a lower playoff team. I don't think they're a favorite for the title team, but I really like the Griffith-King combo. And if they can get 1 or 2 more pieces around that, I think the Knicks can make some noise. So I really liked this trade for the Knicks. For the Kings, it confused me a little bit. I got some clarity later, and we'll get to that when we get to it. The next trade was the Pacers and the Pistons. This was the Pistons trading up from the 12 and the 15 and giving up Mike Woodson to the Pacers to get the number 7 pick. The draft, to me, had two big cliffs, as it were. To me, I thought the top 4 picks, which you know wound up being Jordan Olajuwon, Barkley, Stockton, you can argue about the order of those picks, but I think that was clearly the top tier of picks, and you could maybe say that Jordan and or Olajuwon are their own S tier in the middle of that A tier, but all four of those guys, I thought, the Kings draft preview article notwithstanding, were very good bets. I did think there was a drop-off in the next tier. And I think I mentioned on my podcast where I did take a quick look at the draft, I did think bigs would be at a premium in this draft. And it turns out they were. You know, you had Alvin Robinson going 5, Sam Bowie 6, Kevin Willis 7, Jay Humphries 8. So I thought there was a drop-off around pick 9. So you have your top 4 picks. I think Robertson, Bowie, Willis, Humphries, and I would put Vern Fleming in that category. I didn't think there was a huge difference among Robertson, Humphries, and Fleming. It was more, you know, what your preference in certain areas was were good. And so I can see why the Pistons wanted to get out of 12 and 15 after that drop-off and into the top 9 picks. For the Pacers, who had a season that I think was a little bit disappointing last season, they've been struggling to add pieces around the Joe Barry Carroll and Adrian Dantley combo, and this gives them the chance to take 2 cracks at it, and I think that's a wise way to go. I think it's interesting that they grabbed Michael Cage and Jerome Kersey with those picks. I feel like I keep saying this, and then I keep second-guessing myself. In those slots, in the 12 and 15, I thought they took not only the best players available at those spots, also the players that fit best with their team. They got help for Joe Barry Carroll and Michael Cage. They got a dynamic two-way player with a lot of athleticism to put pressure on teams in Jerome Kersey. We know Dantley is super athletic. So I really liked what the Pacers did. Of course, I've said that the last 2 seasons, and the Pacers' record has declined each of the last 2 seasons. So makes me wonder sometimes if I even know what I'm talking about or if I'm just, you know, totally off in left field. So regardless, I thought this made sense for both teams. The Pacers, you know, could have gotten a guy at number 7 that I think had a bigger ceiling, but I think they had more needs, and so they did a good job addressing needs. The Pistons were trying to consolidate assets to get one really good guy, and I think they did that. So I think that's a trade that I can understand for both teams, and I agree with, for the most part, for both teams. We then have the trade that was announced early but wound up being confirmed late, and that was Ray Williams from the Mavericks to the Cavaliers for Brian Winters and 4 points. This is kind of a wash, I think. I think this was mostly a salary dump. And I don't think either of those players is super impactful. I don't think either one significantly changes the trajectory of the Cavaliers and the Mavericks. I don't think the 4 points are a huge difference maker either way. So this is a trade where I look at it and I kind of shrug and, you know, I mean, yes, Ray Williams is a lot better than Winters, but is he a needle mover? I don't know that he is, and so I'm just – this trade doesn't inspire strong feelings in me. We'll put it that way. So moving on, we had the Kings and the Bucks. So this trade to me was – a shocker. I just talked about how I was trying to figure out what Darth was doing when he moved off of King to get the 5 and 14, and then he turned around and set the 5 and 14 plus Andrew Tony plus Vinny Johnson plus 5 points over to Quayle for Alton Lister and Ford. So if you're keeping track at home, that's Tony on a max contract, Bernard King on a max contract, Vinny Johnson, who was their microwave scorer, no pun intended, and 10 points in all, for Alton Lister, who's an offensive liability, and Ford, who's a decent player. I mean, he's probably in your rotation, but is he a starter? Is he a difference maker? I don't know. I know he's green, but he's never struck me as incredible. He had a good season a couple of years ago in Milwaukee when he averaged 17, but you know, last season he only averaged 14 points a game in 27 minutes. And I don't know. He's a little bit undersized for my taste. They've already got Alan Lavelle. So I think he's kind of redundant. But now I understand why Chad was doing what he was doing by making this sequence of trades and dumping all of that salary, the salary that was a max contract to Tony, the salary that was a max contract to King. What that does is that gives the Kings just enough cap space to go big game hunting. And if I know Darth, he's going to go big game hunting. And when I say that, that means he has a max contract. It's the 25% max, so he's not going to be able to throw a full max at Moses Malone, for example. But for some of the younger players, he's going to be able to try to go big game hunting, and I'm pretty sure that's what he's doing. So Darth would argue if he's able to bring somebody in, the trade was not just King and Tony and Johnson for Lister and Ford. It was for Lister and Ford and whatever player he's able to pick up with that max salary slot. I will say I am not that convinced that you'll see a lot of teams or a lot of players jumping teams this offseason, but it wouldn't shock me to see at least one or two. And if Darth happens to be that one or two, I mean, with guys wanting to play for a winner, he's certainly shown he can do that. So he's got a good a chance as any to get somebody to come in there and take his money. As it stands, though, you know, I'm not thrilled with Ford. Lister concerns me, again, just due to the loss of offense. I know Kaminsky has been averaging 20 points a game the last couple of seasons. Can he increase that as Bernard King leaves? Can Nat step up his offensive production? I think Nat can a little bit. We've seen Nat as the number one focal point. He was kind of 1A and 1B with Bernard King the last couple of seasons. But I'm not convinced that Kaminsky plus Nat is going to get you the same level of pressure that Tony plus King plus Kaminsky plus Nat was. So I think if they don't get their big game in the free agent period, I think the Kings take a step back. Then there's the Bucks. I think the Bucks have upgraded their overall talent level, which is shocking when you consider they just rolled through the league last season and now they're even better. Quayle, I'm jealous. I don't know how you get it done on these trades, but you do. The caveat is the way that the Bucks just rolled everybody last season was they had a super defensive team. They had Lister and McHale and Lloyd all swatting everything in sight. Totally gobbling up everything on the glass and just generally being a stifling interior defensive team, intimidating everybody when they came inside. Without Lister, I think they lose a little bit of that. I like their offense better. Their defense, I'm a little more concerned with. And you know, I've talked before about having a shtick that you build your team around. Last year, the Bucks were built around defense. This season, it seems like they're shifting a little more toward offense. I think they're going to lean on Sleepy Floyd and Andrew Toney to go along with Kevin McHale a little bit more. So they've lost the absolute shutdown defensive identity. Maybe they are going the Blazers route of depth. You know, looking at their team, they're very, very deep. They're very, very young. You know, McHale comes back. You know, it doesn't meaningfully make them any older. So it's a team that's going to be very good for a very long time. And they're not, at least now, in any cap trouble. Now that's going to start changing, not after next season, but after the season following, as Sleepy Floyd is up for an extension. Terry Tyler's up for an extension. Vinny Johnson's up for an extension. Lewis Lloyd's up for an extension this season. And you know, they'll probably let him go. But then, you know, the season after that, they're going to have to pay Malone. And if I know Quayle, he'll be able to shuffle guys around, move them around. I do want to talk for a minute about the Alvin Robertson pick. The Sam Perkins pick I thought was fine. I think, you know, he was a player that, you know, went where he went for a reason. He's a probably, right now, he's probably a borderline starter, going to get to be a solid starter in a couple of years. But let's talk about Alvin Robertson. And I mentioned Alvin Robertson, I think, in one of the town halls, and I thought he had a chance to fall in the draft. He didn't wind up falling. He went up 5, which is where he was projected to go. But here's why I'm a little bit worried about Robertson. And I know everybody looks at his offensive rebounds and thinks, oh my gosh, that should be a guy that Wig loves. But here's the thing for me. He's got good defensive chops, sure, on perimeter defense and steals. The thing that terrifies me with him is that personal foul rating. 33 isn't zero, but it's below average, and it makes me wonder, is he going to be able to play 36, 38 minutes? I think his ceiling might be about 30 minutes. And that just concerns me a little bit. Quayle may prove me wrong. He may find a way to hide him, and the great defense of everybody else on the Bucks may just cover up for that. But that is one of the things that I would keep an eye on for Alvin Robertson, is he able to avoid getting into foul trouble and stay on the floor? If he is, it's a steal for the Bucks. If he's not, I think the Bucks are going to take maybe a half step back this season. Most of their players are young. They're bound to get better. But you'll remember I mentioned before that training camp blasts come about 1 time in 6, boosts come 1 time in 12. If the Bucks take a hit in training camp, they've got so many young players, they can't insure them all. If they don't insure someone and he gets hit, does that take them back a step? I think it could. So I think if I'm the Bucks, I'm a little bit leery of what training camp's going to do to me. I'm still excited about my future, and if I can avoid the training camp smite, I think they're going to be favorites to win it again. In my mind, they're certainly favorites in the East. But I do wonder what giving up Lister does to their all-defense, all-the-time identity. And so, you know, does that give an opening for the Bulls to add another defensive big to Mark Eaton and pass them? I don't know. That's why we play the games. I think it'll be interesting to see. Next up was the Jazz and the Spurs. The Spurs sold off the Cavaliers pick to the Jazz for 9 points. That turned into Frank Bukowski. Again, not surprising. I think Frank went at about the right spot. You know, it could have gone at 17 or 18, but 16 isn't necessarily a reach. So, again, kind of, yeah, it's a surprise that he went to the Jazz and not the Spurs, but is it a needle mover? I don't really think so. I do think it does make it interesting for this reason, and that is that the Jazz get one more arrow in the quiver for trying to take the Midwest division from a Kings team that's suddenly in flux again, particularly one that is counting on a big free agency haul. And if they're not able to get it, there's a chance for the Jazz to try to take a shot at grabbing the division crown before the Spurs and Michael Jordan turn into a beast in that division. Which does lead me to wonder, in, you know, 1 or 2 years, once Aguirre and Jordan and Thomas have all matured a little bit, and Easy is stomping the rest of the division, is Darth still going to insist on trying to push for a title? Yeah, we'll see. Last trade was the Jazz and Bucks. This was another one. The Jazz bought a pick for points. They went out and grabbed Tim McCormick, which, yeah, again, he's a guy. At 4 points, it's not a huge impact. Didn't mean we get to get the draft over with in a single day. At least officially a single day, it was really going for two. But, you know, again, that wasn't really a needle mover for me. So, I thought, you know, for the most part, in terms of who went where in the draft went to form. The interesting things for me were watching to see if my prediction that Bowie and Willis would go quickly came to fruition. Again, not in the top 4 picks, but afterwards. I wasn't surprised to see that happen. I think the Pacers trading down to grab 2 picks instead of 1 was interesting. I liked both of their picks. I thought the Pistons trading up, I liked their pick. The Rockets didn't make a pick out of left field. I thought, you know, Fleming was a solid pick. Was he the best player available? I don't know. Could you make an argument he was the best player available? Absolutely. Was he obviously the worst player available? No. So the Rockets pick at least made sense. I know we kind of banged on them ever since they grabbed Frank Johnson, but there was no pick that stood out to me as an incredible find or an incredible flub. The other interesting thing I guess you could say is the Hawks going for Barkley over Stockton. To me, the more interesting thing is the Suns are going from at least in real life, a generational great point guard in Magic Johnson to another generational great point guard in John Stockton. And regardless of what you think of John Stockton in the NBA, it's an indisputable fact that Stockton is the NBA career leader in assists and steals. And assuming John Stockton in this league in any way resembles that, he is going to be a handful for a very long time. The question is going to be, how quickly can the Suns surround him with talent? So with that, I'm going to wrap things up. I'll probably do a season preview after we see the results of free agency, because there are still very big holes on teams right now. And while I can speculate about where things are going, I'm just, it's very hard to tell with players as impactful as the ones that are free agents. If they do decide to move teams, it's a seismic shift. So it's hard to predict how the league is going to look until I see where those guys settle. So until our next time, we'll let you go. And thanks for riding along with Chat with a Cat.